All right. Thank you very much. And thanks, everyone, for coming out in the morning. I know it's early, so we'll try to be like caffeine. And so just a couple of, I just wanted to make a pitch, an opening pitch for Science for the People, since this is one of three sessions that Science for the People has organized at Socialism 2019. And there's a poster right here on the lectern. We have a meetup on Saturday at 2 p.m., which everyone is very welcome to attend. And there are two more sessions. There's a session on global resistance to extraction and a session on militarism, both of which are going to be tomorrow, and you're warmly invited to come. But some of you may be asking, what exactly is Science for the People? And I can say something very briefly about that, and then we'll get quickly into the session. There's a historical answer to that, right? Science for the People was a group of scientists and activists who got together in the 70s and 80s and published a magazine, invaded the AAAS, presented the Dr. Strangelove Award to atomic scientists, did some amazing actions, some amazing publishing, and then was a sleeping giant for a while. Until now, it has been revitalized. We are beginning to publish the magazine again. There are proofs of our first relaunch issue, The Return of Radical Science, at the SFTP table that you can find next to the registration desk right before you get to Haymarket Books. And the idea behind Science for the People is partly to organize science and to bring the social force and the political power of science to bear on issues like militarism, like the environment, but also to recognize, as I'm going to get into in my talk, that science itself is political and that we need to recognize that in order to really grapple with its impact on society. Okay, so I will stop there. And I'll get started. Yeah, okay. I'll just introduce myself. The first talk will be me. and I'm going to be talking, so one thing is, just quickly, I didn't actually realize that we weren't going to have slides. But I do have slides, and I can give you, if you're interested in the slides that I'm going to be speaking from, I can give you a link. It's a Prezi. So you're actually sort of winning out because you're not going to see the swooping of the Prezi. If you've seen a Prezi before, it kind of swoops back and forth. It gives you a little seasickness, so you're not going to have that. So that's probably good at 9:30 in the morning. Okay, but so what I'm going to be talking about is an issue that came up in the 70s and 80s, but that I think we can recognize is even more crucial now. And that is the issue that sometimes is brought under the umbrella of science communication. And I'm going to be talking about that question with a specific focus on biology and biological determinism, although this has a broader impact in all areas of science, but I'm going to focus on biological determinism. But what I'm going to start with is a critique of what's sometimes called the communication paradigm in science. And the communication paradigm is the idea that scientists should be working off on their own in institutions, scientific institutions, and should pursue objective, institutional, research-funded science, which then will be correct, and then that the way for scientists to make a positive contribution in society is to communicate their correctness to the public and therefore to inform the public about issues, warning, that we're not aware of. And actually, can I get this book? Sorry. I have props. Sorry. I'm going to be sending these around because, and by the way, feel free to stop me at any point if you want to ask something. So in this book, there's an introduction by Sigrid Schmalzer, Daniel Chard, and Alyssa Botteo, and they bring a strong critique against the communication paradigm, which I'm going to be saying more about in a second. And the quote there is, many scientists are frustrated by climate change denial, attacks on teaching evolution. Typically, scientific illiteracy gets the blame. If only the public received better science education. And if only scientists communicated more effectively. Scientists would receive the support and autonomy they need to address the world's problems. Right, so if only this were the case. All right, I'm gonna try not to fall down. I bought these shoes for my grandmother's funeral and I'm gonna wear them. It's gonna happen. All right. They're gonna wear them out. Okay, so one very prominent example of this is the strategy of communicating the consensus on climate change. Right, so this strategy is sometimes used heroically, right? I mean, there's this idea that, okay, we're gonna throw ourselves out there and talk about communicating the consensus and how important this is. But the first thing that I wanna say about this is that there's been a lot of work in the philosophy of science recently, which is my area, as Michael pointed out, challenging the very notion of a scientific consensus, and therefore of appealing to a scientific consensus. So there, I'm gonna list a whole bunch of philosophers of science that you probably don't know, but again, I have the slides, and if you're interested in this work, I can send them. So there's people like John Beatty, Heather Douglas, Kristen Intiman, Matt Brown, Joyce Hofstad, and more. And so there's three main problems that they raise with this communicating the consensus paradigm. One of them is there are problems with establishing when a consensus exists and whether it's justified. So for those of you who are familiar with the sort of large-scale climate modeling, the IPCC uses these things called MIPS, and they're for model integration, and the idea is that it's a way of dealing with the problem of big data, that you find sort of standardized models to say, okay, all of the data has to be sort of analyzed using a standardized model, and then that's how we can create consensus by modeling the data in this incredibly rigorous way. I'm obviously giving a very Cliff's Notes version of this, but that's the basic idea. But just being able to show that there's a single model that can deal with the data, for instance, is not the same as establishing a scientific consensus on some set of problems of interest, and it's especially not the same as establishing the scientific consensus on the implications of science for social and political issues, right, which is a whole separate question. Secondly, there's a problem with whether or not communicating science or scientific consensus actually removes skepticism in the public. Right, or actually increases trust. So Heather Douglas has a really nice paper. If you Google Heather Douglas, Science and the Public, she has some really nice research that she cites on the fact that actually public trust in science, medicine, education, and so forth is reported as very high. And so this seems to be somewhat at odds with the kind of perception that the public doesn't trust science, the public doesn't trust the consensus on the climate, and so forth. But nonetheless, people report themselves as having a very high level of trust in science, in medicine, in their doctor, in journalism, and so forth. And one of the questions then is, how does that work? How does it work that people report themselves as actually trusting these institutions, but in fact, when it comes time to put that into practice, it doesn't really happen? And of course, the third question is one that we're all familiar with here, and some of you probably know more about than I do. How was the consensus established? Was it established on the basis of evidence, or was it on the basis of funding? Whose interests do the results being a certain way serve? Right. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, since I think this is not going to be a hard sell today. but yeah. So these are some of the initial problems with the communicating the consensus model. How am I doing on time? Sorry.
You are
6 minutes.
6 minutes. Okay, that's how much I have.
That's how far you've gone.
That's how far I've gone, great. So the first thing I wanna say about this is I wanna put together a rhetorical model about science communication, which makes, I wanna use a rhetorical model, and I wanna push it a little bit in the direction of analyzing questions of biological determinism. And this makes sense, since rhetoric is really the study of communication, the study of how we communicate things to an audience, how we reach people. And so I want to talk about a rhetorician named Alan Gross. I'm going to talk about other people's work too, but he has a paper from 1994 called The Roles of Rhetoric in the Public Understanding of Science. And there, you're probably all going to start nodding when I mention this. he draws a distinction that's very well known between the deficit model and the contextual model of communication. And the deficit model is this idea, and he writes, it's asymmetrical. It depicts communication as a one-way flow from science to its publics. The deficit model implies a passive public. This is all a quote from Gross. It requires a rhetoric that acts to accommodate the facts and methods of science to the public's limited experience and cognitive capacities. Now, note, this is not what Gross believes, right? This is what he's saying the deficit model has this strategy, right? So the idea here is the public is an empty vessel. Scientists need to fill up that empty vessel with knowledge and facts. And once that happens, then the public will be informed, and then they will make the right kinds of decisions and the right kinds of calls. And the idea here is that there's science and there's the public, there's a gulf between them. We need to communicate across that gulf, and that the goal is to better inform the public of the results of science. The contextual model, on the other hand, recognizes that the public is not missing an understanding of the question in the first place. It's not that the public doesn't have any understanding of the question at issue. It's that the public has a rival understanding. Aw. I would have been so impressed if that had actually shushed. That would have been like, wow. Your mind. Okay, yeah. That happened to me once in a lecture, and that was fun. So the contextual model recognizes that agents who disagree with science disagree because they have another model. It's not because they don't have a model at all, they don't know anything. It's because they have another model that they see as being in conflict with the one that they're being communicated to, right? The deficit model, and this is something that Gross doesn't say, but that I want to get into, obviously, also implicitly assumes that practicing scientists have an uncomplicated relationship to science itself. That is, that there's a single doctrine accepted by scientists, who are a single category, that is to be communicated to the public. It's also a single category. This misses the question of science and its relation to political power. And here I'm going to quote again from the introduction to the book that's going around from Schmalzer, Chard, and Botteo. The education and communication paradigm dominant in discussions of science in society today fails to account for the workings of power. Not that long ago, another approach, you know what this is, this should not be a mystery anymore, rooted in an analysis of political, economic, and social power structures, attracted considerable attention from scientists and others committed to harnessing science and technology to serve human needs. Crucially, this approach disputed the scientific establishment's claim to political neutrality. Okay, so this is science for the people, right? This is what they're talking about. So I want to talk about a specific example for a second. Biological determinism, since this session is on biology. So in the 60s and 70s and 80s, there were heated debates over biological determinism versus the analysis of environmental, structural, political, and social dynamics. These debates crystallized around, and then you should boo when I say that, E.O. Wilson's Sociobiology, the New Synthesis. Thank you. Oh, my heart is happy. Okay, which appeared in 1975. Okay, so Wilson leveraged the modern synthesis of R.A. Fisher, Sewell Wright, and J.B.S. Haldane to argue that social characteristics, as well as physical ones, could be inherited and genetic. Social behaviors were considered to be explicable using sociobiology, which is the title of the book. Richard Lawton, in this book, which I'm going to also pass around. Thank you. I made it. Okay, so Richard Lawton, in the first paper of Biology as a Social Weapon, which is a great title, as opposed to sociobiology, defines biological determinism as, and this is on page 8 of that book, the concept that social arrangements are a manifestation of the inner or intrinsic natures of human beings and are therefore unchangeable. So after the fall of the monarchy, and supposedly the fall of the class and rank system, Lawton says, the notion of the divine right of kings fell away. So it used to be thought that kings could cure scrofula by touching you, right? There was this idea that they had been sort of divinely ordained to rule, and that the class structure was there for, like, because God said so. And then the question is, well, but after the bourgeois revolution, right? We still see social inequality all around us. We still see political inequality. What's the reason for it? Right? If it's not hereditary or if it's not the will of God. And so one explanation is to analyze the social and political structures that benefit from, support, and reinforce inequality and oppression. Another explanation is to say there are intrinsic natural differences between people that explain their unequal social and political power. And that's the Wilson biological determinism strategy. So this debate, this narrative around biological determinism, along with the Manhattan Project, and along with a number of related sort of issues in science, was one of the impetuses for the formation of the original Science for the People. Okay. So beginning in 1969, there was a group of scientists and allies who began to challenge the aims, funding, conclusions, and use of institutional science from within, and it quickly became known as Science for the People. There are a number of allied groups, but that became the sort of main name. So the 1977 collection that's going around, Biology as a Social Weapon, details the influence of eugenics on immigration policy, in the US especially, sexist research into brain structure, and a cabinet full of racist and sexist curiosities. Right. It's a great book. Richard Lewontin, in the initial chapter, characterizes biological determinism, again, as the idea that, and this should, I mean, honestly, if you hear this now, it should sound so unfortunately familiar. This is a quote from Lewontin. Our society has produced about as much equality as is humanly possible. It's so true. And that the remaining differences in status and wealth and power are the inevitable manifestations of natural inequalities in individual abilities. Right? It's this latter claim that's been incorporated into the ideology of the bourgeois revolution and that remains dominant in market industrial societies today. So what does Science for the People mean? Well, first of all, it means not that. And the original Science for the People rallied around a number of key issues that involved opposition to these social movements. So opposition to the Vietnam War, opposition to the use of science for military purposes, critical analysis of that use in the Manhattan Project, in the war, critical analysis of and opposition to biological determinism. And the revived Science for the People, which we'll be talking about at the end of this session and throughout, has been establishing a publishing program and working in action groups to come at these problems again, because as should be fairly clear, these are still problems. Right. So one of the things that's important to note in looking at the work of Science for the People and in looking at this question of biological determinism is to make a distinction between institutional science and science that's in the public interest. So Science for the People is a movement within science, right? It includes scientists. It doesn't just include, I mean, so sometimes people hear the name Science for the People and they think, well, I'm not a scientist. I do this and this. It's, well, no, that's not really the point, right? The point is that science itself and those who are allied with science as a political institution, those who participate in science, so like if you use science in your work, if you're interested in the communication of science, then you can get involved, because the idea is not to just say, let's take the highest caliber, you know, institutional scientists we can find and recruit them. The idea is instead to make a fundamental distinction between institutional science with its, you know, system of rewards and punishments, with its funding from numerous areas that may or may not be actually good for research in the public interest, and making a distinction between that and science that's in the public interest, science for the people, right? That's the idea behind it. And that distinction is fundamental, I think, to the work that is done. And the origin of the movement was in the need for practicing scientists to maintain their activism and principles within an environment where there are dubious uses of science for military, biological determinists, racial, sexual, racist, sexist. I sounded like a congressperson there for a second. Uses of science, of their work and ideas. So one of the reasons for Science for the People is for scientists who object to the way that science is used for communication in the public sphere, in the public market, to actually be able to back up that objection with political action, right, with organized political action. So, for instance, the Manhattan Project is a good example. So, to say something about what is there, so that's a negative distinction between institutional science and science in the public interest. What's a positive way to talk about science in the public interest? I'm almost done, so, because then I want to talk, I want to hear from you. But one way to distinguish, one way to talk positively about science in the public interest is to recognize that science is intrinsically political. Right? Science is not politically neutral. So, because this is my field, I'm going to talk a bit about how this is discussed in STS and in philosophy of science, but there are many other analyses of this. One way to look at this is to look at the fact that scientific theories are conceived and developed in social and political contexts. So this is the sociology of science from David Bloor, Bruno Latour, Chapin and Schaefer, and so on. Another way is to talk about the fact that there's no in-principle distinction between scientific inference and reasoning and political reasoning. This is something that, believe it or not, the logical empiricists actually thought. But in the contemporary context, Christy Dotson, Sandra Harding, Shayla Benhamib, and even others have made this point. And finally, scientific practice not only takes place within, but is an integral part of the polis, civic society. Right? So this you find in Leviathan and the Air Pump by Chapin and Schaefer. It's a flawed book, but a classic in STS and one that a lot of people look at. Azadeh Ashbari has a really nice meta review of reviews of Leviathan and the Air Pump. And again, if you ask for the slides, I can send them to you, and it has a link to that meta review, which is really cool. And it talks about science as a social phenomenon, science as not just embedded in a society, but as a social phenomenon, as something that takes place socially and politically. Okay, how long do I have?
About a minute.
Okay. So let me just say something really quickly, and then I want to wrap up, and then I want to talk. I want you to talk, really. One of the things that the new Science for the People is looking into is this question of countering propaganda about biological determinism. And one of the challenges for that is that contemporary science, funded science, is often inaccessible. It's behind a paywall, can't get to it, and then also even if you can get to it, can't read it, it's not possible, no human being can read it. And then there's all of this stuff out there on social media and on YouTube and so forth that's so much more easy to understand and that links so nicely in with the prejudices that you already have. And it's so great, and there are two sexes. And that's just true, and yeah, that like all of this sort of thing. And so one of the ways that organizing science is effective and important now is to take science from behind the paywall, to make it capable of engaging with broader political movements, broader movements in society, to back up those movements, and to counter right-wing propaganda, right? I mean, and just because that seems like such an obvious thing for a Science for the People to do doesn't mean that it's not something that needs to be done like 20 years ago. So I think I'll stop there. Thanks.
So now we have our second speaker, Stuart Newman. He'll speak for 20 minutes, and we'll have some more time for discussion. There still are some seats up here.
Okay, thank you. It's very good to be here. Lydia's great talk, I don't think. Lydia's great talk and the comments made me decide to talk about something very different from what's in my abstract. So. It'll be slightly related, but I just wanted to get into the history of Science for the People a little bit, because I was involved in the early days, and it was originally centered around the misuse of physical sciences in the Vietnam War, and chemistry, and napalm, and bombs, and atom bombs, and things like that. And biology was there as the biology as a social weapon book attests to, but biology was just on the margins then. We knew about genes and more or less their influence, and the main science for the people issue was based on what we know about genes, which was very little, how could they say that all these social inequities and everything could be attributed to genes? It was just kind of a stupid hypothesis, and people saw it and criticized it. But since then, we've learned how to manipulate genes, and we've learned how to modify them and change organisms and everything. And science for the people didn't go away in the early 80s, beginning in the late 70s, early 80s, around the recombinant DNA issue, and particularly a battle in Cambridge, Massachusetts, around putting up labs, gene splicing labs. There was a new organization that started up called the Council for Responsible Genetics, and it looked at the biology of gene manipulation, the possibility of modifying foods and animals and so on, and started formulating a critique of that. And that led to a great split in the movement. A lot of principles of science for the people actually bailed from the science criticism movement at that point because of the promise of the new genetics as being something that's going to revolutionize medicine. It's not going to be used for bad things, it's going to be used for good things, and how could you be against it? It's science, it's genes, it's and so on. And it was, so basically the Council for Responsible Genetics, which was formed by Science for the People graduates essentially, was kind of on the margins because it was criticizing something that a lot of kind of previously critical and I would say previously left-wing scientists thought were good. And during this period, it was an amazing period because not only was gene manipulation possible, but there was a revolution in the way we understood evolution. In fact, there were evolution wars. It's obvious that the right wing was critical of evolution, and there were Supreme Court cases about the teaching of evolution or not teaching of evolution and so on. But actually, it was a very deep critique of the what's called the modern synthesis in evolutionary theory. Stephen Jay Gould, one of the Science for the People originals, was part of this. And we no longer think of evolution as simply being a function of genetic change. There are other factors. There are environmental, epigenetic, other factors that mold organisms over time. So the evolutionary theory itself is not gene-centric the way it was before. And that was kind of a difficult nut to crack in the science criticism movement because a lot of people who were fighting the fight to sustain the teaching of evolution were advocates of a very unpersuasive model of evolution, which was a gradualist, incrementalist model of evolution, which in a way wasn't persuasive to members of the public, even fundamentalists who criticized it, because it was unpersuasive, the old evolutionary theory, not only because it was against religion. Similarly, the use of genetics in medicine started approaching the question of genetic engineering of humans. Okay, so maybe we could improve the human species by making gene modifications. And we see examples now. There was a scientist in China, Hei Zhenghui, who genetically engineered twin girls with the intent of having them be resistant against AIDS. And this was characterized as a rogue operation of an unapproved scientist. But in fact, he was aided by American scientists. There are scientists around the world that see this as an experiment. Of course, it's an experiment on humans that don't yet exist, so it's not really part of medical research, it's part of eugenics. But there's a lot of liberal scientists, people who see themselves as progressive, that are pushing for this. So I would say that we have techniques now that can modify genes very precisely, but what the genes are doing are not what people used to think that genes were doing. Okay, so basically there's this mechanical idea of how genes act on organisms, which is now known because of our new understanding of how evolution works and how biology development works. It's not, genes don't do the predictable things that people used to think that they do, okay? So that's changed in the last 30 years, the understanding of that. But people who are biotechnologists and bio-entrepreneurs are still pushing this idea that if we could modify certain genes, we could make human beings better, smarter, whatever, more musical, more athletic, and so on. So there's this whole eugenics program. Now, the other side of this is that there are positive uses of the technology. So if we take the traditional province of medicine, curing cancer, curing diabetes, and things like that, there are real promises of these genetic modifications done on people who are sick and don't have any other possibilities. There are going to be genetic cures, but to apply this to early embryos and try to make improved people from the outset is really a misappropriation of this technology for eugenic purposes. Okay, so I hope that distinction is clear, and maybe it could come up more in the discussion. But fully developed person is kind of modular. You know, if their liver is impaired, you might be able to correct their liver. That's not changing the whole person. If you do the modification at early stages of development, you're doing many different things at the same time that are uncontrolled, and this is human experimentation with really no purpose except to make experimental people that are somehow going to be better than they would have been. So, but you see that people don't make this distinction, and there are a lot of liberal pro-science people that say, you know, why not genetically engineer humans? And there are lots of fundamentalists and conservatives that say, no, don't mess with human embryos. So basically, it seems to me that on a lot of these issues, the real enemy are not the fundamentalists, but the liberals. Okay, and this has come up again and again. The whole question, so during this whole period since the kind of the decline of science for the people and the kind of the reorientation of the critique of biology, we've had very intense abortion wars in American society. And there are people that say, you know, why not engineer the embryo? Why not use human embryos as experimental models and see if we can make them better? Because they're just embryos, okay? So the fundamentalists say, no, don't experiment on embryos. Don't waste embryos. Don't use them as scientific reagents. But liberal pro-science people say, oh yeah, it's why not? Why not try it? You know, it's just a scientific experiment. So again, there is a kind of problem with the kind of the advocacy of genetic modifications, and you can see it in agriculture as well. At the beginning, it looked like genetics was going to be a positive value in agriculture. You know, why not make plants resistant to you know, bad climate, or to so you can use less herbicides, less pesticides, and everything like that. Well, it's turned out to be a mess. The you do genetic engineering, and you have to use pesticides and herbicides to keep out the non-genetically engineered crops, and then those cause cancer and so on. So, and the crops themselves are not necessarily beneficial. They may be good for the companies, and they may allow them to patent the seeds and to prevent other people from using their monopoly crops, but they really haven't been better for people's health. So, but if you read the New York Times, you see all kind of the liberal pro-science people are saying, yes, genetically engineered crops is science, it's genes, it's great, it's going to be good for humanity. And you seem to be sort of a Luddite or an anti-science to criticize it. So again, the problem seems to be the liberal pro-science people. So it gets into exactly what Lydia was talking about. You know, is it really a kind of a misunderstanding of science, or is it kind of science as a social weapon that is involved here? How am I doing with time?
You've got 5 more minutes.
Okay.
No, we've got 9 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
There's the time.
Okay, well, now there have been some recent things in the news that kind of bring out these kind of contradictions in a very clear way. So, going back about 15 years ago, there was a federal ban on making stem cells from human embryos, and it was advocated by a lot of right-wing people, the ban. And but in fact, the process of making human embryos and genetically engineering them, cloning them, making stem cells out of them is really kind of on the track of this eugenic modification of the human species. So basically turning human biology into a commodity, making prospective future children a product. Okay, so that ban, I supported the ban actually, even though I'm a developmental biologist and I could have done work that, you know, might have led to certain understandings of human biology. But I think a lot of this work, just about all of it, can be done on mice and frogs and fruit flies and so on. But in any case, there was a ban. California had an initiative to spend $3 billion of tax money so that they can fund genetic engineering of human embryos. And it passed, with a lot of deception. And this book that is listed on in the program, Biotech Juggernaut, that I wrote with Tina Stevens, a historian of bioethics, recounts this California incident and all the lies that were used by the pro-corporate, liberal, Nobel Prize-winning scientists to claim that if you manipulate an embryo in a dish, it's not really an embryo, call it something else, and so on. And it passed, and now California is funding this. But what's happened is that women have been enticed to voluntarily donate eggs at the expense of their own health to this research program, and then when not enough eggs were coming in, the California Institute violated its precept and started paying women for eggs, and this is a real health problem. So here, a biological reproductive entity is turning into a commodity. Similarly, there's been a ban very recently. So in Britain, they now have what are called three-parent embryos. They make that certain families have mitochondrial diseases, so they're making children by taking parts of an egg of one woman and mixing it with parts of an egg of another woman and then fertilizing it and minimizing it by calling it mitochondrial transfer. Well, the mitochondria is what's impaired, but what's being transferred is a cell nucleus. It's a very elaborate, very messy procedure, and it leads, at least in mice, to presentable looking mice. You know, presumably the children that result from this are going to be human, but they might be impaired in a way that we don't know about. But this was sold to the British public in a very deceptive way, calling it mitochondrial transfer. Mitochondria only have 23 genes, you know, but it wasn't mitochondrial transfer. This is banned in the United States, and the ban was going to be renewed. The ban was going to be tossed out a month ago, and it was liberal representatives with constituents who were scientists that were pushing to do it in the United States. And just at the last moment, a number of people, Nita Lowey, my congresswoman, flipped because she received some information that had just been published in Science magazine a week before that showed that there were evolutionary compatibilities between mitochondria and nuclei of cells, and that if you mix and match them from different individuals, you're going to mess up this evolutionary, this co-evolution. So this caused her to flip. And the reason why she got access to that article, which nobody had known about, which was the key thing, was that I was called by a right-wing congressional aide, a congressional aide to a right-wing congressman from Nebraska, and asked if I had any scientific arguments against doing this. And I just happened to have read that article, and I told this guy about it, and he told a scientist that was known to Nita Lowey, who then told Nita Lowey, and she flipped. So we don't have it, but and it's good that we don't have it, but the liberals were pushing for it, and it would have probably been a very bad thing if it went through. Okay, I'll stop there.